mission. We run the crowd loud. Fist pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, Banned Books Week for 2014. This year, Banned Books Week focuses on graphic novels. We'll be joined by the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Charles Brownstein, and the American Library Association's Barbara Jones to talk about Banned Books Week history and this year's focus. We then move to discuss one of this year's recent cases of book banning regarding the miseducation of Cameron Post in Delaware. We'll hear from some of the involved parties, including librarian of the Dover Public Library, Marjorie Sear, Susan McAnally, manager of Browse About Books in Rehoboth Beach, and also a recent high school graduate, Maddie Bacon, all of whom are active in the struggle to fight censorship of books in our schools and communities. We'll round out the show with a quick update from former CIA analyst, transparency and civil libertarian Ray McGovern. Please stay with us. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we are going to be taking a look at Banned Books Week for 2014. Yes, that's right, banned books. According to the American Library Association, it may surprise some to find out there are literally hundreds of reported attempts to ban books every year in the United States. And it may be even more astounding for them to hear that since 1990, the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom has received reports of more than 18,000 attempts to remove materials in schools and libraries for content deemed by some as inappropriate, controversial, or even dangerous. This year's Banned Books Week is spotlighting graphic novels because despite their literary merit and popularity as a format, they're often subject to censorship. Graphic novels continually show up in the ALA's Office of Intellectual Freedom's top 10 list, and the most current list for the past year includes two graphic novels, including Dav Pilkey's Captain Underpants series. Doesn't that sound dangerous? Here's Peter Phillips to introduce our first two guests. Peter?
Our two guests are on the line with us. First is Barbara Jones, is the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom and executive director of the Freedom to Read Foundation at the American Library Association in Chicago. They sponsor Banned Books Week, to choose Privacy Week, and all the ALA member activities that have to do with censorship, privacy, and the First Amendment. Charles Brownstein has served as the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund since 2002. During his years at the helm of the organization, they have successfully managed several First Amendment cases. The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund participates in a wide variety of challenges to unconstitutional legislation. They watch how they've grown their budget. They have a full-time staff now in New York City. And welcome, both of you. Barbara, let's start with you and really tell us why we still need a Banned Books Week.
Thank you for asking that question, because books are still being banned, and people don't recognize that. People just assume, oh, surely this has gone away. Surely people can find the books from a friend or through Amazon.com or some other way. But the truth is that some people still can't afford books. And in this economic downturn, there are people where books have just fallen off their family budget. They just can't afford them. And if the libraries ban them, they are stuck. They really are stuck and can't get a hold of them. And we see the numbers staying fairly steady in terms of books pulled from the shelves, sometimes by well-meaning people who think that somehow pulling a book about teen drugs will make teens quit taking drugs or committing suicide or something like that. And so we keep seeing books being banned every year. We need to make people aware of that.
Barbara Jones, thanks again so much for joining us. Project Censored is a proud member of the coalition of people that help plan and work on Banned Books Week.
Yes.
It's such a very, very important endeavor, and we're very proud to be part of promoting that. BannedBooksWeek.org is one of the websites you can go to. Of course, we have it at the front of our website, ProjectCensored.org. And let's bring into the discussion Charles Brownstein. You're at the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and this year's theme theme is graphic novels, so that's very apropos. You've long been associated with BBW, but let's hear some more from you about the danger of comic books, the history about comic book banning, and why graphic novels is the theme this year. Charles?
Right. You know, it's funny. The more things change, the more they stay the same is the old cliche, but, you know, unfortunately, that's the truth. This year, as we've seen Captain Underpants and Bone on the American Library Association's list of challenges, and we've seen challenges to Persepolis and Fun Home in academic environments come 60 years after the United States government actually placed comics on trial in Senate subcommittee hearings that were linking comics to juvenile delinquency. And that was back in 1954. So, you know, back in the 50s, there was this concern that comics were going to be a negative influence on youth and encourage them to engage in delinquent and difficult behaviors. And that created this stigma that comics are low-value speech and that comics are not real books and, in fact, are harmful reading material. 60 years on, academia and the popular culture has come around to the idea that perhaps that moral panic was overstated, but we're still fighting that stigma. We're still seeing teachers and librarians risking their jobs for bringing this meritorious medium into their libraries and classrooms. So, you know, sadly, even though, you know, we've got this history, even though we've got the last 20 years of great graphic novels, it's still a fight that needs to be waged with some regularity.
So, Charles, tell us a little bit more about some of the specific titles and, you know, again, why do you see this trend now? Graphic novels are more and more popular. They're more and more part of curriculum. So maybe talk to us a little bit about a couple of the ones that are on the list and maybe more in your experience.
Yeah, sure. I mean, globally speaking, comics are one of the most commonly attacked sorts of books. They're uniquely vulnerable to challenges, in part because of the medium's visual nature. So a book of prose is something that has to be taken as a whole. The images are only as disturbing or titillating or lurid as the viewer's own imagination, whereas a book of static images can fixate on the single panel and find things, for instance, in, say, Alison Bechdel's work, where a single panel can be pulled out of context and the basis, you know, for a challenge. In terms of the specific titles, you know, this is where you run up against the other area of attack, which is that there's still the stigma that comics are low-value speech, that comics are not a legitimate form of learning. And so we've got two very interesting challenges that have occurred in the last year. One, shockingly, at the university level, it was announced that Alison Bechdel had won the MacArthur Genius Grant for her body of work, and among that body of work is the graphic novel Fun Home, which was the target of a university funding battle in South Carolina, where it was assigned at the College of Charleston to incoming freshmen as a voluntary reading assignment, prompting outrage from a local values group. This ultimately went to the state senate at the beginning of the year, where there was an attempt to defund the school for assigning this and another school for assigning LGBT material. And then last year, the Chicago Public Schools was embroiled in a controversy that Barbara can speak more broadly about, involving the graphic novel Persepolis, which was the target of an attempted ban. And in that particular case, it was very heartening to see the students actually rise up and take action to say that this material matters to us and is of value. And so you're really running into this matrix of reasons that, you know, partially it's always going to be content driven in the same way as any other form of book, you know, whether you disagree with subject matter or whether you disagree with language or whether you disagree with depiction of lifestyles. But you have the added complication about the fact that this is a visual medium and that this is a medium that has historically been described as possessing a lower value than strictly prose materials.
Charles, hi. I remember as a child that comic books were, they had a stigma. My parents wouldn't buy me comic books, and I have always wondered about that. And then, of course, the left critical analysis is that some of these comic book series, Disney and that, had ideological orientations. So what we're talking about now is a long history of a stigma of comic books in some way being inadequate or a problem. And that has turned into an area of kind of continuing censorship. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
That's exactly correct. And where before the censorship was self-censorship on behalf of the industry to permit it to continue to be sold on the newsstand. You know, you might remember when, you know, you were buying comic books that you weren't allowed to buy. They all have the Comics Code Authority seal on it. That went away in 2011, and now the censorship is actually happening at the level of libraries and schools, where that old stigma pervades in some environments and it does lead to these sorts of censorship events.
Charles Bronstein, our publisher, Seven Stories Press, has just published another volume of the graphic canon with Russ Kick.
Such a great series.
Yeah, and Paul Buell, you know, doing the People's History of American Empire. My colleague Adam Bessie at Diablo Valley College working with Dan Archer and others on education and so forth. I mean, this is a really bustling, burgeoning, it's a vast, growing medium reaching more and more audiences of people that maybe won't sit down right away and read larger nonfiction texts. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. I mean, in addition to being a popular form of storytelling that appeals to readers of all ages, comics are a really unique and powerful way to encourage literacy. And they're especially vital in the 21st century, where so much of our literacy is actually visual as well as textual. And because of that synergy between art and text, comics are great for reluctant readers. They're great for English learners. They're great for people who have learning disorders such as dyslexia. And just in general, the skills that readers develop from reading comics provide a practical foundation for other kinds of learning that are just so important to living in the 21st century.
Barbara Jones, tell us a little bit more about last year's struggle. We had you on the show last year for Banned Books Week, and one of the big controversies was surrounding Persepolis in the Chicago School District, and we had a couple of young students on who were fantastic. But could you remind our listeners a little bit about what was that about?
I'd be happy to. Persepolis was taken out of the Chicago Public Schools curriculum, and our office heard about it. And since we're in Chicago, we're also, most of us, citizens of the city, and we were very concerned, and we heard from librarians in the Chicago Public School system, too. They were just outraged, although the book was not taken out of the school libraries. So we right away got onto it and found out that, as far as we can tell, after filing FOIA requests and everything, one parent objected to this book, and as a result, it was taken out of all the public schools at all levels. And so the Chicago Public Library proudly put on their website that they had 18 copies, but of course that didn't even get close to the demand for the book. And what happened is that, as you mentioned, some kids, some high school students at Lane Tech rose up and had a sit-in in the halls of the school. I think 700 plus students were in the halls in the sit-in. And also, we joined them in a protest on a chilly, freezing rain afternoon to protest on the corner of their school. And we had big semi-trucks honking their horns to support the First Amendment. It was quite an event. And it was really heartwarming to see students themselves getting so outraged that this book had been removed from their curriculum, actually. So we fought really hard, and I think because there was some embarrassment involved, I think the Chicago Public Schools had no idea what a problem this would become for them in terms of PR. And as of now, I believe the book has been returned to the curriculum except for seventh grade level. But we'll take what we can get. We'll continue to work on it. And the other good news is that Marjan Satrapi, who wrote the book, Persepolis, will be here in Chicago this year on November 1st at the Chicago Humanities Fest. And I'm sure it will be sold out, standing room only.
Barbara Jones, you're director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at American Library Association. Who are the protesters, so to speak, or where the origins of banning come from inside the community? Sometimes these are parents. I think a stereotype in my mind would be they're sort of fundamentalists, perhaps right-wing Christians, but I don't know if that's true or not. So really, what are we talking about here?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because you're right that there is a stereotype that it's fundamentalists And that's true, but there's more to it than that. We now have added a group of parents who are usually highly educated, possibly PhD educated, and upper middle class, and we call them helicopter parents. And these are parents who, in the olden days, would not have censored books, but are now, and I've talked to grandmothers who say that their children won't let the grandparents read certain books to the grandchildren. So it's a generation of parents who are really concerned, more than my generation was, about what kids get in their hands. And for reasons of child development, or in particular, because books might be too violent. So comic books could easily end up in this category. Also, if anybody still considers them low-value work, as Charles mentioned, that could be another reason. And so we're really fighting this on a lot of fronts now. And there's no one type of person who is going to censor a book. And I just want to add that sometimes these people are very well-meaning. These aren't a bunch of crazy folks. They really think that by removing a book that violence in it, it will prevent violence in the community. And what we try to do is encourage them to get involved in anti-gun violence groups or do that instead of removing a book, which is sometimes well-meaning but doesn't really solve the problem.
You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. Today's theme is Banned Books Week. That was Barbara Jones, the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom and the executive director of the Freedom to Read Foundation at the American Library Association. She's joining us from Chicago for the first half of the program today. We're also joined by Charles Brownstein, executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Charles, I want to go back to you because one of the resources that was put together this year is something called the Banned Books Week Handbook, and people can find out about that at the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. That's CBLDF.org, CBLDF.org. Charles, talk to us about this handbook.
Absolutely. This is a free download or a print publication that you can get from your local comic book store this week. It's available absolutely free to patrons, and it basically outlines the scope of Banned Books Week. So we have a Comics and Censorship 101 that walks through the basis of Banned Books Week and why comics and books are banned and challenged. It walks through a variety of case studies, including Bone and Persepolis and The Sandman by Neil Gaiman and Fun Home and many others. It also walks through important Banned Books Week myths. For instance, the whole idea that I thought comics weren't banned in this country, or if you can buy a book, it isn't really censored. And perhaps most importantly, it has pages of suggestions about how you can get involved in fighting for the right to read in your community by knowing what's happening, reporting censorship, supporting local libraries and teachers, and then a variety of programming ideas. Because, and I think Barbara and everybody on the committee for Banned Books Week would agree, Banned Books Week is really about the idea that more speech is always better than less speech. And while people that do want to limit certain kinds of speech or access to material that they, in their sincere hearts, believe is detrimental to their communities, developing conversations and making sure that everybody has the right to approach content, you know, will do more good in the long run. And so we've created this handbook as a way to help patrons and individuals bring these values to their community and just ignite the conversation, start the conversation so that we can have meaningful exchanges within our community to promote learning and to promote freedom of expression.
Charles Brownstein, I would like to ask you, because this certainly comes up on campuses, about hate speech. And if a comic book is filled with hate speech, racial stereotypes, really tremendously gross things, should we be banning these?
Well, you know, again, more speech is better than less speech. And what the First Amendment guarantees that an idea has the right to compete in the marketplace of ideas without being impeded by government and without being restricted. Once it reaches the marketplace of the ideas, certainly the environment can reject those ideas. The environment can say, we find these ideas offensive or distasteful, and, you know, here's a battery of competing ideas. That's healthy. What's unhealthy is removing the idea at all. And so, you know, absolutely there are a variety of ideas that are offensive, but that doesn't mean that they don't have a right to exist. And the freedom to read in the First Amendment means engaging with the ideas, even the ones that make us uncomfortable, because we have a more durable and a more vibrant and a more intelligent society through doing so.
Charles Bronstein, certainly at Project Censored, we could not agree more with that statement. Barbara Jones, I don't mean to throw a curveball here, but I am just curious, because we are broadcasting from Berkeley, California. We are approaching here the fall of 2014, the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. Have you seen much of what was going on this past week with Nicholas Dirks?
Yes, I have been following
it. About how free speech is supposedly, it's important to be civil and respectful. Yeah. And of course, Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education and others really blasted back, and Dirks retracted and clarified his statements. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I certainly could, because I've been pretty busy on this, too, because I'm in Illinois, where there's been a problem at the University of Illinois.
Oh, there has. Indeed.
Professor.
Yeah, Professor Salita, yes.
Yes, because of his tweet. And here's what I have to say about that. That is that civility is important, but the First Amendment trumps any kind of civility, so to speak. As Charles just said, there is a lot of speech that's going to offend somebody. And if we went totally in as campuses or as libraries to respect everybody's feelings, we wouldn't have anything left in the library on the shelves. And so I think it's important to have what Justice Brennan called robust and wide open speech that sometimes offends people. And he said that in the Times v. Sullivan Supreme Court case. And we here at ALA couldn't agree more with that assessment. So I'm concerned. First of all, I would hope that all students would feel welcome at a campus like Berkeley, but that the First Amendment doesn't become a victim to that, that students should feel free to speak out on any number of things. And as Charles said, more speech solves that problem by somebody saying, I'm really offended at what you just said about my culture, and it's not true, and here's why. And so I think civility can go too far.
Indeed, especially if it's used as some kind of coded speech to create a chilling effect that'll prevent people from bringing up these discussions. Again, the idea is more speech, more choices.
Yes.
Of course, later in the program, we'll be talking about the miseducation of Cameron Post. The ALA, in fact, offered suggestions of, well, making other books available on assignments for students instead of banning one.
Right, exactly. We always would argue for more speech, and that would be one strategy. If for any number of reasons somebody doesn't want to read a particular book, we're not going to be in a position of forcing anybody to read anything. But at the same time, they should have an opportunity to, if they're in school, to finish their assignment. And so we would offer alternative books if students, for one reason or another, are uncomfortable with a particular title.
Yeah, and certainly the idea of having it available is what's key here. I mean, as a parent, I certainly have an interest in what my children are exposed to. I don't use the term helicoptering when it's me. I call it attachment. But the point is that it's not that people can't still make these individual choices.
Exactly.
It's that the choices are actually available and people are more educated about these forms of expression and why they exist in the first place.
Yes, precisely. And librarians are happy to work with families or with teachers or whoever to come up with what's appropriate for that particular family and not to force something on a family if they really don't want to read it. At the same time, their neighbor's kids might want to read it. So that's why we believe the book should stay in the library for another person to read it.
Barbara Jones of the American Library Association, ALA.org. And Charles Bronstein, I wanted to come back to you. Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. In the next 90 seconds, give our listeners some places to go and learn more, and just give us some of your closing thoughts for Banned Books Week coming up here.
Yeah, absolutely. If you'll go to cbldf.org and bannedbooksweek.org, you'll see a full schedule of events happening around the country, so look for one near you that you can get involved. Please take this opportunity to go out there and celebrate in your community. Go to bannedbooksweek.org and cbldf.org to learn how you can do more. And let's just get out there and celebrate why more speech matters.
Barbara Jones, ALA, last word for this segment.
Yes, I would echo everything that Charles said, and I would add another website, which is www.ala.org/bbooks, and there you can find hundreds of video clips of people reading their favorite banned book, and you have an opportunity to do the same thing. Also, we are sponsoring, along with the Sage Foundation, a webinar on Wednesday, the 24th. Everybody is welcome to join that for free, and you can learn more about that on the B-Book website. It will include two speakers to talk about the impact of banned books on the Latino community. And as Charles said, I urge you to go out and do something in your community. Write an editorial. Have a readout. Do something in your community.
Barbara Jones, American Library Association, thank you so much for joining us and all the work you do for ALA, for Banned Books Week. Charles Bronstein, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, thank you also for your great work supporting comics, supporting free speech, and supporting Banned Books Week. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
After this musical break, we'll be back with more on Banned Books Week. Stay tuned. Tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, the theme is Banned Books Week. It's between September 21 and 27. You can learn more at bannedbooksweek.org. Of course, if you go to the front page of projectcensored.org, you'll see a great banner there with the American Library Association press release. And you can learn more at the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, cbldf.org, a whole handbook for this. These are great resources for teachers, and we're glad again to be able to host the program on Banned Books Week this year. Right now, we're going to turn our attention to a recent case in book banning in Delaware. This is regarding the miseducation of Cameron Post. And we are going to be joined here by Margie Sear, who is a librarian at the Dover Public Library. We're also going to be joined by Maddie Bacon, who was a student this past spring involved in the struggle fighting censorship of this book. So, Marjorie, are you with us?
I am.
Thanks so much for joining us. And Maddie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks so much for taking time out. We're going to try to get Susan McAnally, a manager of the Browse About bookstore in Rehoboth Beach, on as well, if we can get in touch with her to put an independent bookstore angle on this. But while we're doing that, Marjorie, tell us about this book, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. First of all, tell our listeners about this book, and then tell us about the controversy.
Well, The Miseducation of Cameron Post was written by Emily M. Danforth, and it's a story about a young girl who learns that she is a lesbian, and within days of learning that, her parents are killed in a car accident. So she has a lot of emotional issues, blaming herself and her sexual leanings and connecting that with her parents' death. But it's really the story of her growing up and coming of age and learning about her sexuality and trying to do that within a context of a very small community and a family that is very conservative.
So where was the opposition coming from? Was this we shouldn't have books about lesbians? Was there an emotional content? Maybe let's go to Maddie and ask you. You obviously read this book and you're protecting, wanting to make sure people have access to it. What was happening at the high school? What was there opposition from other students?
Well, I personally did not meet any student that was against it. I did go to the one of the board meetings where they discussed it, and there were several parents. The official reason that it was banned to begin with was because of profanity, and then at the board meeting, more of them brought up that it had graphic scenes and talked about drug use and that they didn't want their kids reading about that.
And this was a reading list for students over the summer, correct? Marjorie, go ahead.
The Cape Henlopen School District, for the first time this summer, instituted a summer reading list that was based on the Blue Hen Award teen list. And the Blue Hen Awards is a list of contemporary books. They're nominated by readers themselves, and a team of librarians in the Delaware Library Association read those books, create a list, and then the readers vote on their favorite books on the list. So there's 5 books for each year's teen list. So the school district's reading list for the incoming ninth graders was the Blue Hen Award teen list for 2014 and 2015. So The Miseducation of Cameron Post was one of those titles. There were 10 titles that the students could choose from.
So this is only one of the titles.
That's true. The advanced placement, the honors students had to read 2 books from the list, and other students had to read 1 book from the list.
So, Maddie Bacon, back to you. What was your involvement then in sort of fighting back to have people be able to read this book, having the opportunity?
Well, I had just recently graduated this past spring, and I saw in the news the newspaper that this book had been banned, and I was thinking, hey, I just graduated from there, and I looked into it, and I realized that they were banning this book, and I work at the bookstore, Browse About Books, so I, even more, as I was working there, was always constantly aware of what was going on, and I felt very passionately that this book should not have been removed, that it was hurting the students at Cape to remove this book. So I went to the one school board meeting where they voted to take the whole list away. And I spoke out there to the school board members, and I also wrote them letters afterward and sent them to them.
What did you say?
Well, it was a pretty long letter, but basically what I said was that removing Cameron Post from the reading list was really harmful to the LGBTQ students, regardless of their intentions, because I was just in those hall rooms and those classrooms like months ago. And the students there use gay derogatory terms, and they make anti-gay jokes. And I know people, some of them who were very close friends, that were uncomfortable being open about their sexuality in that environment. And if we're ever going to change environments like that, we have to start in the young minds of the future. So reading books like Cameron Post, they're meant to expose students to new viewpoints and experiences. So having this positive representation of a lesbian girl could have helped a student connect and find a literary character that echoes their thoughts and feelings. And I think it's that people underestimate the feeling of knowing that you're not alone, even if it's just a book character. And even other kids who didn't necessarily connect with being a lesbian could have seen the harmful effects of bullying and homophobia, and they could have been discouraged from partaking in those acts.
Maddie Bacon, I just can't say, I'm giving you virtual high fives from across the country on the left coast. What you did was so important, and standing up for that, and standing up for the right to read and the right to experience these things. And it's especially important that young people are taking up these very important fights. So kudos to you for taking that on. Susan McAnally joins us now by phone. She's the manager of the Browse About Books in Rehoboth Beach that Maddie just mentioned. And Susan McAnally, you also got involved in the issue surrounding the miseducation of Cameron Post. Are you with us?
That is true. Yes, Mickey. Hi, I am.
Tell us about this. Your independent bookstores serve a great purpose in the community, and you waded into this battle, so to speak.
Well, we did, and we weren't, you know, when we were not anticipating this turning into quite the media event that it did. I mean, we're happy that it, we're unhappy that the situation arose, but I'm really proud of our community, the way people rallied behind us to support us in what we did. Once we learned of, you know, the removal of the book from the list, we were approached, first of all, by a group called After Ellen, and they had asked us if we would be able to act as a hub for members of their community to donate copies of the book to any student that was interested in reading in it. And of course, we agreed to do that. And we were thinking that it was going to be sort of a small group of people, and that perhaps we'd order 20 books and 10 would be given away. What happened is, once the media got a hold of this, we ended up having donations not only from After Ellen, but from people in the community, including Cape Henlopen teachers, from other random community members who came in essentially throwing money at us and saying, thank you guys for doing this. We had donations from the publisher, HarperCollins. We, as a store, donated copies of the book. So all things said and done, we managed to give away about 250 copies of this book.
That's a fabulous story. Thank you so much for that. Marjorie Sear, after the school board just did away with a reading list, well, you took a position along with the Delaware Library Association. Could you tell us about the letter you sent, and what's been the outcome of that?
I'm the intellectual freedom chairperson for the Delaware Library Association, and our position was from the very beginning is that people have the right to read. And they have a right to choose what they want to read, but other people do not have a right to make that decision for them. And because this list offered 10 different titles and students were only required to read one of them, we thought that the list certainly provided enough opportunity for students to be able to choose different titles if they didn't like one of them, or if they didn't believe that that one was appropriate for them. So our point of view was that this was about the right to read, that it really wasn't about the particular book. And that was really the stance that we took. So we got involved in this early in the game, I think. This first came to the school district in May, and the complaint was brought to the school board by a family who complained, as Maddie said, about the language in the book. And at that first school board meeting, the school board just decided to eliminate that particular title from the reading list. And it wasn't an agenda item. It was just an item of discussion that came up from the floor. So at the June board meeting, the school district's attorney met with the school board and advised them that freedom of information laws require that the school board just can't take action on a non-agenda item without advertising it to the public. So they reinstated the book to the reading list, and then they made a motion to eliminate the entire reading list.
That seems like you're throwing out the entire reading program. They're still trying to ban one book. I mean, this wouldn't have happened if that hadn't come forward. Is that correct?
Well, yes, that's correct. And the stance that they have consistently taken is that it was about language and not about content.
But no one was obligated to read the book. It was just part of a list of 10 books.
That's correct.
And then your position was, well, fine, put 20 books out there or whatever.
Our position was that they needed to give the students more options to read than less. You're right. If they had a list of 20 or even 50 books, that would be more appropriate than removing one or removing the entire list.
Susan McAnally, let's go back to you on the from the independent bookstore angle. You know, sometimes the independent bookstores may not wade into some of these conflicts because of, you know, blowback or customer ire or what have you. What was your experience? And you know, you made this decision, and what was your experience in the community again?
It was resoundingly positive. We were thrilled that our community was behind us, and I really feel like a lot of that is because we do have, I mean, obviously we have a great community of people, but we were very cognizant of not taking a political stance about it. Any of the media that we did regarding this, we weren't critical of the school board, of the people on the school board, of the people who made the complaints. We took the stance that as an independent bookstore, it is our job to put books in people's hands. And we're very passionate, especially about putting books in kids' hands, in teenagers' hands. So, you know, our stance was we're doing what a good independent bookstore should do, which is encourage kids to read broadly and read well and to put books in their hands. But it's not our job as booksellers to tell kids, you know, unless we're asked, of course, what they should be reading. It's our job to put these books in their hands and say, hey, you know what? You make the decision. Because you can't have well-read, well-rounded adults if they're not exposed to a variety of scenarios. And even if you didn't agree with the stance of the book, in my mind, those are talking points with your children. If you don't agree with the book, then you talk to them about why you don't agree with the book. If you do agree with the content, then you talk about that. But everything is a learning experience. So our goal was just to say, hey, you know what? You guys make the decision. You decide. You read the book first, though, because that was a point of contention about this, is that none of the school board members had actually read the book.
That's even more riveting, Peter.
Maddie Bacon, what have you learned from all of this? So you're a graduated high school senior. You were working at the bookstore. What kind of a lesson is this for you and your peers there in the community? And maybe someday you might want to run for school board. Tell us what you think.
I'd vote for her. This whole experience has just been overwhelming. I mean, I felt very passionate about it, and then I went to the school board meeting by myself, and then I ended up running into other people I knew that I didn't even know would be there, and we were all standing up and saying what we spoke for. And even though we didn't quite get what we want, it felt good to be speaking our minds and telling people that we disagreed and just fighting for what we believed in. And what really made me think about this situation was that pretending that something doesn't exist won't ever help kids keep kids from experiencing it. So these parents that wanted to hide these books keep these books off the reading list because they don't want their kids reading this mature material. I mean, ignorance is never really protection, because if we don't educate these kids about these things, whether or not it's something we want them to do or want them to not do, it'll only leave them not knowing how to handle the situation when it arises. And it just kind of blew my mind, the responses of some of the administrators and the parents who were claiming that the language in this book would never be heard in the cafeteria. And I would just like to say, as a recent graduate, that most of the foul language I know today comes from the cafeteria at that school. So a little bit inaccurate to say that.
Maddie Bacon, again, we're beaming over here. Peter and I are professors, and with Project Censored, we work with hundreds of students and scores of professors and people across the country, and we just get really charged when young people stand up for free speech and stand up for, you know, the right to know. And we really want you to know how proud we are of you all in this struggle. And Marjorie Sear, we have 2 minutes left here, 1 minute left in the segment. I just wanted to conclude with you with some of your thoughts and maybe if people can learn how people can maybe learn a little more about what happened, if you have a website or anything to give out.
I think Maddie's absolutely spot on. As you can't pretend that things don't exist or things don't happen. And to try to protect your children from the reality of life just really does them a disservice in the long run.
Oh, I think we lost Marjorie Sear there, and she was just concluding by agreeing with Maddie Bacon, the former student that was helping fight for the right to read, the miseducation of Cameron Post. And Susan McAnally, you're still with us?
I am.
Really quickly, could you just give us last words here?
It's an unfortunate situation, but I think for our community, it was perhaps a wake-up call. I think people, you know, should think about these issues when they vote for people on the school board, because a lot of people forget that the school board is a political appointation. So, you know, that the people should think about these sorts of issues when they are or are not choosing to cast the ballot.
Susan McAnally, Browse About Books, Maddie Bacon, Marjorie Sear, Dover Public Library. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your struggle for free speech. And thanks for joining us for the Banned Books Week special in the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having us.
I'd like to thank everybody that was part of the Banned Books Week segment this year, including Judith Platt from Association of American Publishers, certainly Chris Finan at the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression, Maggie Jacoby, and all the people that I've worked with on the Banned Books Week committee. Thanks again so much for all of your efforts. To learn more, go to bannedbooksweek.org. Up next, Ray McGovern. Stay with us. listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We close out the program today with transparency activist, civil libertarian, good friend Ray McGovern. And here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, to give Ray a proper introduction. Peter?
Ray's a CIA analyst, starting in the administration of John F. Kennedy all the way up to George H.W. Bush. His duties included chairing the National Intelligence Estimate, preparing the president's daily brief. In 2003, Ray helped create Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was being used to falsify just the war. He's been traveling around Northern California, giving speeches under the auspices of the American Civil Liberties Union. And Ray, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be back with you.
So what is your main message today? What are the issues you're really focusing on?
Well, Peter, usually people set up a dichotomy between human rights and the need to keep us secure. There need not be a dichotomy. We have a constitution. It protects our rights. And actually, a Fourth Amendment, which has been played fast and loose with, is all about security. You know, the right of the people to be secure starts out. Secure in their persons, houses, their papers, and their effects shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, supported by definition of the places to be searched and the people or things to be seized, period, end quote. It's very, very clear. And so when people say, now, how much of that amendment do we have to abide by? Well, hello. Yeah, there's an orderly process to amend amendments or amend the Constitution. You abide by the whole thing until you change it. It's not like Dick Cheney could come in and say, well, which he did, actually, Peter. He called the head of the NSA and the unscrupulous Michael Hayden, and he said that we know about that first commandment out there at the NSA, thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant. We know about that. Forget about it, Mike. Forget about it. And to his dishonor, instead of honoring his solemn oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, Michael Hayden saluted sharply and instituted this blanket surveillance, which is crass violation of the Fourth Amendment. And then for services performed, they made him head of the CIA. I mean, is this a great country or what?
That's certainly an interesting story. You've been very involved in foreign intelligence issues around the wars. Can you talk a little bit about the contemporary issues around ISIS and what's happening in Iraq today?
Sure. Peter, in a word, it's as though our White House, our government, only has one hammer, okay? And it's our military. And every problem in the world, particularly in the Middle East, is a nail. So if you only have a hammer, what do? You drive the nail in, okay? Now, our top military, and I have great respect, by the way, for General Martin Dempsey, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and who, at precisely this time last year, prevented an unnecessary expanded war against Syria by telling the president, look, you don't have to do this now. You don't have to do it. You can do it any time. And when the president got up and reversed what his Secretary of State said on the 30th of August, less than 24 hours later, Obama says, we're not going to strike Syria. We can do this tomorrow, the next day, or next month. There is no, quote, time sensitivity, end quote, to this. And we're going to go to Congress to get appropriate authorization. It was Martin Dempsey that insisted on that. And now what is he doing? Well, the president says, we'll have no boots on the ground. And Martin Dempsey is saying, look, American people, please realize that this is a real slippery slope. We've been there, done that. There's probably going to be boots on the ground. And I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to say we'll never put boots on the ground. I'm going to say what the truth is. And that is, if we need boots on the ground, I'm going to advise the president we need boots on the ground. It'll be up to him. So there's quite a different gloss on this, but at least Dempsey is being honest enough to say, you can't do this from the air. and you can't depend on surrogates or people like the ragtag Baghdad army that David Petraeus is so proud of training up, four divisions of which ran away when the ragtag army from ISIL came in from the north of Iraq. So Dempsey, at least, is putting a sane voice here. And this business about him and the president, you know, differing on these things, well, yeah, they differ a little because the president is most interested in the rhetoric and most interested in assuring Americans that we'll not put boots on the ground. But Dempsey is saying, look, look, we're going to have to probably, and that's what I'll advise the president. So maybe that will militate against the president getting involved in another stupid war just because we have a hammer and everything looks like that.
Marie McGovern, Mickey Huff here, Project Censored Show. Thanks for joining us once again. You know, corporate media propaganda here has been pretty relentless once again. Gore Vidal once referred to the Americans as the United States of amnesia. we really need to fight against this kind of relentless pro-war propaganda that we hear all the time, every channel. And the other issue, too, is the deception involved historically. We've always been at war with East Asia, if you recall George Orwell. 1984. These are real problems, and how are you going about combating some of this disinformation, misinformation?
Well, you know, it's kind of easy, Mickey. I just tell the truth. That's what I did for the 27 years with the CIA. And, you know, the odd thing, Mickey, is that when I tell the truth, I base it on facts, and people listen. And I've had people come up to me and say, you know, it's so nice to have a fact-based analysis of this because we didn't know any of this stuff. And it's stuff that's out there, but it's out there in the alternative media, like your show. It's not in the Washington Post, not in the New York Times. And so people say, well, if it's not there, it must not exist. Well, it does exist, and that's what I'm trying to do, spread some truth.
Ray McGovern, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for all your work.
Most welcome, Mickey.
I'd like to thank everyone who was on the program today. Charles Bronstein from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Barbara Jones of the American Library Association. Also like to thank librarian Marjorie Sear, Browse About Bookstore manager Susan McNally, and Maddie Bacon. Thanks also to Ray McGovern. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Thanks to Anthony Fest. Thanks to Erica Bridgman. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. To learn more about how to bring this program to your community, look us up on projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Ritualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the ties for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters. We got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters, the people.